and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 653. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicory, and joining me as ever is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, dude?
Happy New Year, everybody. It's good to be back. Glad to be back. There's a little racing going on, but, well, you've got the biggest news of anybody, bud. So, you had a great holiday, right?
You had a very busy holiday. So, where we left off, if many remember, some many weeks ago, Jim and I were saying, like, hey, we should probably do, like, an off-season show. And I was like, yeah, we could do that. And I was like, yeah, we'll get maybe knocked it out before Christmas because my son was going to be here around about the 10th of January. But the doctors had been telling us for a while that he may need to come out 2 weeks early just to avoid some my wife has high blood pressure, so they wanted to make sure to mitigate any issues from that. And so we're sitting there the week after Christmas. It was the week of Christmas. And that Tuesday, my wife comes walking into the room. She's just like, I got an email from the doctor, and it says our induction date is 29th. So we're like, wait, you as in like next Tuesday? She's like, yep. I'm like, shit, I got things to do. So luckily I had taken some time off for Christmas for family, and I knew I was going to use that time to get ready, get the room all ready, just kind of make sure I was 100% like, okay, like let's have this kid. And a good thing, so we spent the rest of the week just kind of getting everything ready, and we went in on Tuesday. And so we had to wait a little bit to get everything going. A couple days there, my wife had to put in some labor. And then sure enough, he showed up on New Year's Eve in the afternoon, around about almost 3 o'clock. And Grayson has now made his appearance to the world.
Excellent. Everybody's happy, healthy, the whole nine yards?
Yeah. He had a little bit of a jaundice, so we had to clear that out. Yeah, so we had to clear that out before he kind of... he just got off. He had some special equipment that we brought home with us, and we got that all taken care of. So he's getting fat now, which is good. That's what we want. He's, you know, he's eating well. He's, you know, doing all his baby stuff very good. He's getting a little fussier now that he's aware of the world around him. And mom and dad are getting zero sleep. I can assure you of that.
That's normal.
Yeah, because when we had him on an every 2 hour feeding schedule, so. At first, we just thought maybe we'd get up every 2 hours, but then we soon realized that by the time you get up and you feed him, that's not a 5-minute process. It's 30 to 40 minutes of him knocking down that bottle, and then usually you'll change his diaper before because he's gone to the bathroom. He'll go to the bathroom during while he's eating, so you change that diaper. Then you got to calm him back down, get him back down, and all of a sudden it's about an hour and a half, and you're like, oh, I've got to wake him back up in about 30, 40 minutes to eat again. Awesome. So at that point, you just stay up. So me and the wife have been doing a lot of tag team where after dinner, I would go to bed about 6, 7 o'clock, and I'd wake up around about 10, 11, grab him. She'd tag out. She'd go to bed, and I'd be up with him till about 5 o'clock in the morning or so. And then she'd come back out, make breakfast, we eat, then I'd go knock back down for a couple hours and then get up, and then we'd just kind of take care of him in the middle of the afternoon, and then we'd start our rotation again. So,
woo.
Yeah, it's
Well, I remember those days. Okay, I'm having PTSD.
I've been learning a lot. It's been a week, but it's crazy to sit there on the couch. I look over and I'm like, oh man, he's here. Like, I just signed up for a lifetime of this. Oh wow, this is insane. And there's all this, like, during the delivery and everything else. I remember him being here. It's just a rush of emotions that hit. I just couldn't believe, like, I have a kid, and he's going to grow up, and he has all this potential to do all these things in the world and live his life and be happy and see things and do things. So I'm like, wow, that's crazy. And I'm responsible for the well-being of all that. Who decided that was okay?
Who made me boss of this operation?
Yeah. So it's been good. And like I said, everybody's happy, healthy, which is the main thing. Mom is doing good. She's a little sore. She's, you know, she's got to recover from her own stuff. I mean, for God's sake, she just, you know, delivered a baby. That is not easy.
It's truly a miracle, though, isn't it?
Yes, it very much is. It is insane to think how that starts and how that finishes 9 months later.
Yep.
It's quite the process. And to see him come out and, He looks you right back in. He recognizes my voice right away. He was fussing, and I started talking to him. And you see him, like, he looks up and opens his eyes, looks right at me, and he calms down. And I'm just like, wow, I mean, they really do recognize you from the get-go.
Yes, they do. So,
yeah, and so that's why, ladies and gentlemen, there's been – we have not – Motopod has not been on the radar.
As it should not be.
No, I have yet – I have barely kept up with the news. I get like 5 minutes to myself a day in between everything to kind of do non-baby, non-paperwork, non-parent-related stuff to just kind of maybe check. I get to check maybe a YouTube video a day, I think, is where I'm at right now. Maybe one or two articles on Crash or Motor Matters, and that's it for me.
It's going to be that way for about the next 4 years.
Yeah, I imagine so. And then, you know, number two might be around in that time as well, so... Oof. Don't be surprised if we have to maybe do some extra hosts or updates to how we do the show going forward, because busy time in the Vicroy house, that's for sure.
Very much so.
But yeah, Jim, it is good to be back. It is the new year. Like you said, we've got some racing going on. Dakar has launched. Supercross is around the corner.
Yes.
And yeah, that just, you know, it just trickles in, because then we start going, you know, for our car. You know, fan racing out there. You know, we got our Daytona race, you know, NASCAR and the 24-hour.
24 hours, like less than 3 weeks away.
Yeah, and then, you know, then you know, of course, for me and Jim, you know, we get F1. I know we won't talk about it much, but, you know, that comes for us. Me and Jim, big fans. Yeah. And maybe after the show, I'll talk. I'm actually going to go to the race this year, Jim. So, yeah, going to be doing that in Texas. We thought maybe get a little international. Then all the quarantine rules are still in place right now, and I just don't have time to. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would love to go anywhere for 2 weeks, but the wife is not. She gave me the pass, but not a 2 week pass. I can tell you that much right now. but yeah, so Motopod. Well, we're not really going to be covering motorcycle racing, but we're going to cover some news. But Jim has some very something exciting to tell you folks, and it'll remind you of what the Jim version one we had on the show used to do all the time. What do you have for us today, Jim?
Oh, at the end, hang around for the end of this show, because I speak with Freddie Spencer. Yeah, that's right, the Freddie Spencer interview. It's 40 minutes. It's good. It's really good. It was amazing. Yeah, you got to hear it, guys. You really do. We talk about his book Feel. We talk about some of the bikes that he's raced, and we go into at the very end, because I only had 40 minutes with Freddie, and at the very end, we did a little bit on his position in Dorna and Chief Stewart, and, you know, not anything that was a call or any kind of things that happened in race direction, but how he sort of got to race direction and how the changes they've kind of made and those little things like that. Plus, I think there might be a world exclusive in here somewhere. He starts talking about how he's getting ready to write a second book, or sorry, not a second book, but another book. And I've not heard that said anywhere in any news platform that I've been looking at. So you guys might be hearing a world exclusive on that one. But I'm really excited about it. It is my first time I've ever interviewed anybody for the show. And if you're going to aim for the skies, you know, you got to go big or go home. And
that's right.
I went big and I did it. So I pulled it off. So I'm kind of proud of myself.
No, I'm excited to hear it. I have not heard it yet, but it's the Motopod of old, when we used to have all kind of crazy interviews. I think a lot of us who've been around for a long time, when Jim used to do that and bring in, that really made this show what it is. So it's nice to kind of get back to maybe getting some of those interviews. I've been reaching out to some folks. I've kind of got some soft commitments at the moment, but between my schedule and their schedule and some time zone challenges, may or may not work out, but, you know, we're going to see. And you know, Jim, it's, you know, once you get in the club, it gets easier and easier to find these guys.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that one. So hopefully we've kind of figured out how to sneak in and no one was watching the back door, and hopefully we'll get a lot more of these.
Yeah. So, all right. So anyway, we do have some donators this week, and they're names that you are going to recognize for sure. These are the folks that keep the lights on. They keep everything going, such as Scott Sunter, Alan Fleming, Keith Kovac, Nick Saban. Long time donors of the show. So we thank you, gentlemen, for your kind donations. And remember, folks, if you want to be like one of these fine gentlemen here, you can donate to the show. You can go ahead and go over to Motopod at motopod.com on the left hand side, or motopodcast.com. Start reading the email address. Out of practice, don't hold it against me. But anyway, motopodcast.com on the left hand side, you'll see the PayPal buttons there. You can donate a one time donation, or you can sign up for a subscription for as little as $2. If PayPal is not your thing, we also have a Patreon site that you can go to donate through. That's patreon.com/motopod. Any bit helps, keeps the lights on, keeps us going to tracks, keeps these interviews happening. You know exactly what it is. So we keep it ad-free, just like you want it. You just want to talk heroes, bantering and going on about random stuff and making no sense and making some sense and making all the sense all at the same time. Just go ahead and donate. We'll keep the lights on and we'll keep it going for you. All right, Jim.
Yes.
So it's news time because, you know,
that's what we do.
It's the season for news. There's not much racing. So why don't you go ahead and lead us off?
So I think the bombshell that no one saw coming in makes 2021 seem like 2020, or more to the point, it's like 2021 looked at 2020 and said, here, hold my beer, watch this. We get David Bravio of Suzuki has left a world championship winning outfit, left cold turkey, gone, and he's going to be the principal, team principal for the F1 team Alpine, which is the Renault team. And if you don't know what Alpine is, it's like their tuner group kind of car, kind of like what Ruff is to Porsche or Callaway is to Vets. So, he's a people person. He's managed to make Yamaha successful. He's made Suzuki successful. He somehow figures out how to make people work together and move in one direction and move together in that one direction. And he's been successful at it. That's sort of what you need to have in a Formula One team. So he's probably going to excel at it, but that is still shocking news that he would walk away from MotoGP just like that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely fits his MO as well, right? He came, he had a job, he built it up. He didn't say that's why he left Yamaha, right? Went to Suzuki. He achieved his goals with Yamaha. He achieved his goals now with Suzuki, which, by the way, I think he got there a lot faster than most people thought they were going to get there, which is all kudos to them and that team. And going over to F1, when F1 calls, you listen.
Kind of like when Honda calls or Ferrari calls, right? Like we always say, exactly. If they call, you sign, you go.
That's right. I mean, and that's a big team. That's a big factory. Renault is the largest manufacturer of cars in the world?
No, Volkswagen Group is.
Okay. It's one of the largest. And then, of course, they will all be taken over by Chinese companies in the next 5 years, no doubt. But that is just out of nowhere. I mean, there was no smoke on that. That was just, oh, by the way. And it's like, excuse me, what?
I poured gasoline and dropped my lighter in a puddle.
Seriously.
Just did not see it coming.
No. I mean, that's good for him. And that's interesting. And we're going to see how this affects the Suzuki team this year. It's going to be very difficult for them to repeat championship form, as it is for anyone at any time, unless you're Marc Marquez. But then again, we may get to that later. But anyway, so the next bit of news we have here is the Anshu twins. They survived a horrific road accident when their van was hit head on by a lorry, which is, a semi truck here in the United States. That would happen in Turkey. They're both okay, thankfully, but they're a bit shaken up, as you should be, considering that a giant truck hit you head on. All kudos to the manufacturer. I don't know what brand of van that they had, but woo, five-star safety is a real thing.
Yeah. If you go to crash.net and you look at there's a picture, or you could go to Instagram and if you follow Pichetti, World Superbike team. I can't do Italian like you can, Skylar. But they've got a picture of the van, and it is destroyed. So for them to come out with just cuts and bruises and stuff is quite amazing. So they were actually on their way to Keenan Safoglu's ranch where they were going to do some practice and whatnot. So, well, like I said, it's 2021.
Yeah, and, I think 2021's got a bit of a hangover from 2020, so.
Oh, yeah. Talk about like hangovers, man. Fausto Grassini remains on a medical ventilator, or sorry, mechanical ventilator, in an intensive care unit in a Bologna hospital as he battles severe respiratory insufficiency caused by COVID-19. Now, everyone says that he's getting better and he is having to use the ventilator less and less, but that's scary. I mean, I don't want to see, that would be really bad. I mean, that's like a very close member of the MotoGP community. I think, you know, he's been on the show with Martin, and I think we all want to send our best wishes and speedy recovery to Fausto.
Absolutely. Heal up, bud. We want to have you back in the paddock and, you know, if you can, back on the show as well. All right. So next bit of news. Our title-winning Ducati and Honda MotoGP team manager Livio Supo says, if Suzuki calls me, I will listen. So on the back of Davide Brivio leaving, that's very possible that they're going to be calling.
I think they'll call, but I don't think Suzuki will do anything. I think they're going to stay pat with what they have, because the head Japanese man, I do not know his name, and I probably should have looked it back up again. But he is capable of running that team. And him and Brivio both sort of had the same mindset about what they were trying to do and where they were going. So I don't see – if they want to bring in Supo, that's fine. But I think Supo upsets the apple cart, and I think he totally upsets the harmony that they have in the team. So I that's wishful thinking, I think.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, that's kind of an agent play, right?
Sure.
And we say that all the time here at free agency in all of our sports, that there is a quote-unquote leak, and it comes from the agent because they want to get that name out there, and they want to get those stories and putting pressure on people to start making those moves and like, oh, yeah, maybe I should do that. So that seems more of what that might be, but you never know in the paddock there.
Yep, definitely. So testing in Sepang is ready to go, but they are waiting for government approval. So the Sepang government has not yet said, hey, you guys can come in and you can, do your testing gig here. So I'm not sure if they're going to do this sort of like as a micro bubble where everyone comes in on a charter flight and they all have particular transportation that takes them to a hotel, and the only place they can be is the hotel or the track. I don't know if it's one of those things where they're just trying to work out those fine details about what's supposed to happen, but let's just keep our fingers crossed that we at least get testing and we kind of have like a more regular and normal season. We've already lost the Isle of Man for this year, so I don't want to see any more stuff, you know, lost. I mean, there definitely can be problems with this. Formula One is facing the same sort of problem. The Australian government is standing firm, rightfully so, on their, hey, if you're coming, that's fine, but you're going to spend 2 weeks in quarantine before you ever go out and you ever get to the racetrack and start doing your work. So consequently, that race has been postponed because there's not enough time between the last preseason Formula One test and when the first race is supposed to happen for them to quarantine for 2 weeks. So maybe we're going to have some of those issues that may or may not crop up as we head through with the MotoGP season. You know, when I was talking to Freddie, they're talking about how UK is in another lockdown. If that happens, you know, in July when we're supposed to go to Silverstone, does that mean Silverstone doesn't happen? Does it get postponed? This is all that we've got to figure out now as we try to move forward and work with the virus as opposed to try to defeat the virus. And every sport is that way here in America. NBA basketball, NHL, Major League Baseball, everybody's had to deal with players in NFL been having to deal with players that have COVID and postponing games and shuffling things around and moving it. And of course it kind of works because there's no people that are going to show up in the stands anyway, right? So, this is one of these things. This is going to be fluid. You know, we have a schedule. I don't think that schedule is going to be upheld any way, shape, or form. There's going to be stuff that's going to get changed on it. I just don't know what, but there's going to be something that gets changed for sure.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if it's anything like, I was looking to do the F1 race this year, it's it's all hold your place in line purchases at the moment. You buy it and there's guarantees on money back and everything else, and basically you're just buying the right to reserve that ticket when it comes up, right? So I'm sure there'll probably be a lot of that. That's also, you know, very it puts tracks and promoters in difficult positions as well, because they have to budget for these things, and a lot of times what they do is dependent upon pre-sale of tickets. They're like, okay, we're expecting to see, we've already sold 60,000 tickets, we can go ahead and do this, or we can add this, or we have this much food on site because of this many people on site, so on and so forth. So when you start you know, having to guess, it gets very difficult. And tracks financially, 1 year missing a race and being subsidized by lower rates by MotoGP. I mean, MotoGP is going to want the full buck this year because they need it as well. It's going to be another tough year. And everyone's going to have to remain very flexible. And, you know, should something such as an outbreak happen in the paddock, you know, of course, this is something they're going to prevent. I still think we're going to be seeing very, you know, restricted paddocks again, especially in countries where it's rampant, Texas. And, you know, just try to keep things contained as best as they can. You'll see it'll be different in different places for sure.
Yep, for sure. So Turn 10 at Barcelona will be modified to a combo of the old Turn 10, the big sweeping left-hander that we used to have, and mm-hmm. the shortened chicane-style F1 corner that we've been using the past couple of years. Kind of glad to see that happen, because a lot of the riders thought that F1 chicane sort of ruined the flow of the circuit. There is a track map of the new diagram on crash.net. Look it up. It'll show you that if you don't know exactly kind of what it should look like. It's tight coming in, and then sort of now it's instead of being like one big constant radius arc semicircle that they're going to go around, it's sort of a very tight radius coming in, and then the radius opens up and you can accelerate out of it. So hopefully that'll be a little different and we'll see some better racing and fewer crashes at that turn than we've seen in the past.
Yeah, it's good they finally fixed it, because everybody was now, it just looked botched at this point, right? With them having to adjust. Now they can make it look, again, flow better, look better. And I'm kind of glad they're making the adjustment and just going ahead and just solving that for both F1 and MotoGP at the same time.
And lastly, the thing in the news, Marc Marquez has had a bone graft on his broken humerus. They took bone material from his pelvis, grafted it into his humerus bone, and they had to do it because the break was not healing, and this is the last option to fix it. So a little scary here, but Mark, from all pictures and stuff that I've seen on Marquez's Instagram, everything's looking good. He does have his arm in a brace in most of the pictures, so I guess he's not opening windows or anything now. So mm-hmm. that's a good thing. I think he finally realized that, like, if I want a shot at riding a motorcycle again, I got to do nothing with this arm. He hopes to be at Sepang. I can see him being there. I could see him maybe doing a few laps, but he's not going to be putting in the heavy-duty workload, not by any stretch of the imagination. All that work is going to be done by Espargaro and by Nakagami. So,
And his brother. His brother will probably.
Alex is going to
ride. HRC contract.
Yeah, Alex now, is going to ride. Certainly, yes.
Yeah, they'll throw him on the bike if they need to test out anything as well. Stefan Bottle, too. He'll be there to do his testing duties. I mean, you know, obviously we don't need to beat this dead horse. Me and Jim have been on this.
What's the show?
And all I gotta say is, you know, I hope this works.
Me too.
I don't want to see him walk away from the sport. He adds an element to the sport that is just exciting. And it's once in a lifetime kind of riders, right? Although we've gotten it twice in a lifetime with him and Rossi, kind of. We've been a little spoiled with that kind of stuff. But it's bone graft is no joke. That's a major surgery. And a very complicated one at that. So, like you said, I've seen this brace. That brace is serious, too. Mm. It's not just I'm propping you. It's like locked in place. Like, you're not moving the arm from this specific angle. So, he's playing it serious, and it's good that he is, which will probably lead to him healing up. Now, like you said, I think he'll if he does go to distance paying, it's just a, can I still do this test? Like, can I actually ride a bike? Not how fast can I ride this bike? It's just going to be like, can I put pressure? Can I withstand it? Because as everyone who has either done a sport or competed in something that's very strenuous on the body, no matter how much you practice or how much you theorize, you don't know until it's game time what you can and can't do. So, yeah, you can go to the gym and put, you know, bench press and like, oh, yeah, this simulates this many Gs. It's not the same. It's not the same as you slamming the brakes into a corner and the bike moving around and you having to get lateral Gs at the same time as you're getting those. So it's going to be a test for his body more than it is for that bike.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's not really much that they're changing on the bikes anyway. They pretty much development had been frozen on the bikes. So you know, I mean, there's certain things that you can test: tires, suspension, settings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not like we're going to whip out three different engines and six different chassis and figure out, whoa, which one do we want to go race with? No, not happening. So, yeah, you know, I mean, there towards the end, man, that, you know, 2020 bike was not that bad. So we shall see. It's all up in flux. But yes, I still am working on doctors for interviews for the upcoming show on Save the Riders from Themselves. So it's in the works, people. It's just been difficult to get some things done. So, well, but hey,
holidays
and everything else. Yeah. And trying to get people who want to talk about it. So I'm struggling with that part of it because they don't really want to talk medical things. So I understand that, but anyway, and that's neither here nor there.
Right. So, all right. So that kind of wraps it up. I know there was more news minor that kind of went through. Those were some of the bigger points I wanted to go. I remember I read Tsuda Nagashima. He is done racing. He's going to pack his bags up and he's retired from racing now. After having a great start to his Moto2 season last year with that winning Qatar and just kind of fizzling out the back eventually. I think he's just maybe passion or maybe just the wear and tear of the grind of traveling through the world and being away from home. And I think he's got a little kid too. So
couple
kids. I'm pretty sure that, you know, that's playing on him when he had to be away for so long last year. And he's just like, you know what? Like, this isn't what I want to do. You know, a lot of people get that reality check sometimes when they, you know, have to give up everything. They realize, oh no, I'm not willing to do that. But yeah, definitely. It feels like we're still a ways away, but we really aren't. I mean, with the season lasting so long and everything lasting so long, and then getting through the holidays, the new year, and just everything that happened for the world in between that, what's continuing to happen right now. I mean, it's going to be here before we know it. It's insane how fast time goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to fly by, and we're going to be, you know, show after show after show, just racing, which is going to be great. So, I mean,
yeah,
we just can't get there fast enough. There's, you know, vaccines are being distributed. It's going to take a while, but I think there's light at the end of the tunnel for this one.
Absolutely. And eventually I can get back to having a beer instead of a sparkling water on the show. Because let me tell you, alcohol has not been anywhere near me since Christmas, because after I started prepping, I knew I was not going to be able to drink for quite some time. This guy is basically, I'm hungover as it is without the booze at this point. My brain half works. I have a headache sometimes. I don't think clearly. I have weird hunger cravings at 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it's like I'm drinking. I'm just not drinking.
Yep. I know. I've been there. Did it twice.
Yeah, there's other people right now that are they're shaking their head like, mm-hmm. We knew that was coming. There's other people going like, "Ooh, that's why I'm not going down that route."
All right, everybody. I think we got you caught up to the news, at least the big issues and whatnot. I think it's time that we hear from Freddie Spencer. Don't you think so?
I do believe so. I got to get out here and get some dinner for everybody. So it's a good time to punch it. And we're right just about at 30 minutes, Jim. So, I guess, take it away, Freddie and Jim.
Hello, Motor Potters. This is Jim with a special Jim's Corner. I have a very special guest. I'm honored to be talking to Freddie Spencer, who is a MotoGP legend. Freddie, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's my pleasure to be here. And for everyone out there, that I want you to know, Jim got up very early this morning because it's 11 o'clock here in London, where I'm based. So I appreciate you getting up this early.
Oh, no problem, Freddie. I appreciate doing the interview with me. I want to talk a little bit about your book, Feel, and
yes,
your career as it kind of ties into the book. And then hopefully at the end, maybe one or two quick questions sort of generally about your role with race control. But my first question is that I read Feel. I thought it was an amazing emotional roller coaster where you really kind of laid it out and bared your soul. What made you want to expose yourself like that in print?
Well, it's a very, very good question, Jim. It was really that period of time in the fall of 2010. You know, I went through 29 years of racing, as I talked about in the book, from 4 years old until I was 33, and then a few months off, and then basically went right into doing my school. And my school was that transition from all of the focus being on me and maybe just my team, which is what racing, especially at the professional level, is like. At the elite level, you know, it's every lap, every weekend, it's just the intensity requires such an incredible amount of focus and awareness to be able to compete at that level and then to stay at that level. And so the transition to doing the school, which happened in 1996, and then I started in March of 97, did that for 11 years. And then after that, when the school was ending in 2008, it was also the same time my marriage was ending. And I'd always been a type person that I didn't really talk very much. I grew up in a very conservative environment in the South, in Louisiana. I was also extremely shy and very introverted in that respect. And so I didn't really talk about things I experienced. But I was always a type person that didn't really talk about things. I did things, you know? And that is to me what I was, one of the things I was trying to show and get through and feel was an insight into my mindset. It's why I call it my story. And it doesn't have every detail in there, but it has the details that influenced me and things that shaped my thinking, taught me what I believed in and what I focused on, my purpose in many ways, which was racing, and, you know, starting at such an early age and the environment that I was in. And then that whole aspect of being so shy, but at the same time doing something that exposed myself to everything, criticism, so outside my comfort zone. You know, I've said many times, I'm not that big of a, I don't even really like taking a lot of risks, never have. Or the attention from the winning was something I dealt with, not something I craved. And so whenever, you know, I went through my divorce and the school ended, it really was a time in my life to where I said, okay, what am I supposed to do with all of these things that I've learned? I love to teach, which is what my school taught me. I love to talk about ways to help others. What I have experienced, how can I help someone else with that? And that was the next step, was I begin writing, as I talked about in Feel. I left Las Vegas and ended up at this place, the courtyard Marriott with others, and I realized I was there and helping others in ways that sometimes we miss, which again, I was trying, that was one of the points I was making with Field, was I had these dramatic experiences that are adrenaline, you know, driven, you know, standing on a podium, all these things that I'm extremely thankful for. But at the same time, all of those experiences were, for me, were no more important than being there with Miss Ada or what I experienced again with others in ways of connecting. And they actually blended and helped each other. You know, riding a motorcycle taught me to believe in what I could do. It enhanced what I see, what I sense, what I feel. All of these all these things that to ride a motorcycle. It's one thing, one reason I love what we do. And why did I have spent so much time promoting motorcycling and still involved with it? And so that's why I wrote about what I did, you know, things that I'd never talked about before. And it was time to, you know, it just actually felt like the right time to do it. I would have never done it before that. I would have never talked about it in interviews or anything. But it was time with the book.
That kind of leads me to my second question. In the book, you talk about so much that you overcame. The fire that hurt your hand.
Yeah. Yeah, when I put the fire, yes.
Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, all these other things that you overcame in racing, the wrist injuries and things of that nature. I looked at the book as having a hidden message that was, you should not give up on your dreams. You should try. You right. have to do. Was that something you wanted to come out in the book?
Yes. I you know, most people, again, because I never talked about it, you know, they look at the things that I accomplished. And then you're almost looked at as being above struggle. You know, that it's easy for you. Look at your talent that you have, which, you know, have, you know, people have written many times about, he's so naturally talented, and he makes it look easy. I've said many times that, yes, it's hard to make it look easy. You know, all the hours I spent in the yard, and I was not in any way trying to say, look at me, look at all the hard work I've gone through, look at all the struggles. Not at all. You're correct, you know, in the fact that the reality is, you know, falling leaf fire when I was, you know, 2 years old, and Levy C pulled me out of it. It was, you know, I was so young, obviously, I don't really remember it. I vaguely, as I talked about in the book, I can still close my eyes and hear my sister screaming. And you know, I guess when she was holding me in her arms, and you know, I was, they told my mom and dad that I would lose my hand. And for all the way up until, you know, I was 8, 9 years old, I couldn't even get sun on my hand. I'd have to wear a sock on my arm. And it hurt a lot whenever I would ride, especially in the cold, you know, in my yard. But those things made me stronger. And that is certainly one of the points of that I was, you know, by talking about it, I wasn't, again, making it, trying to make a point other than this is what I experienced. And one of the great things that have come out of the book is people get different things out of it. You know, they relate to, you know, maybe some of the personal struggles I've experienced, or they relate to an injury struggles, or they relate to relationship, you know, struggles. Having a purpose, that's one of the big things that we all are looking for. I'm very fortunate. It was something that I just have never known not to have, is a purpose. Even when, like I said, when it came time to write the book and to talk about things that I never talked about before, I knew it was the right time. But I think that comes from awareness and paying attention. It's one of the things that I have audio recordings for a second book that I'll be writing, which will not be so motorcycle oriented. It's going to be more the personal observations and understanding and things on a life scale. But it's one of the things that I believe so much in is that, you know, we're given those glimpses, given those moments to, and we have choices constantly of, you know, what we should do. As I talked about, as you know, in the book about how I got to Honda, everything laid out, I should do the Kawasaki deal, but inside, deep inside, it just didn't feel right. And went against what everybody suggested. And that's not always, you know, I didn't do it because everybody thought I should do it or shouldn't do it. It was in just something inside me told me differently. And it was, you know, that picture when I was 6 years old that I saw, or it was, you know, different reasons, you know, the 79 British Grand Prix that when I saw them, the failure, but I knew when I saw Mr. Honda, I connected it to that picture that I saw when I was young. And so, you know, there's all those aspects that, that really to me gives direction and gives inspiration, you know, and it's almost a practical way of thinking about being inspired, Jim. You understand? Most people do things on just pure emotion. You know, like they get excited about something, and then as soon as that emotion starts dying down, well, then they start losing confidence in it. I've always believed that having belief and faith is much more practical than we treat it. And I'm very clear about that, very focused on that. And that helps me have a much clearer understanding of the choices I make.
So you talked about people, just to back up a second, you talk about how people interpret different things from the book. One of the things that I looked at and I remember from my childhood racing experiences was traveling in the van with my dad and my mom. And you talk about that with great fond memories. It really stirred something in me when I read that part of the book. Do you look back at that time as like one of the best times of your life? Or is it just that it's just fond memories?
Oh, I look at it as an absolutely very fond and great time in the warmest of ways. As I mentioned about the fact that I, when I was in Road Atlanta and doing the broadcast, you know, the AMA National, and it was in 99, and I just thought to call home, you know, and I changed my travel arrangements and flew to Shreveport and spent 3 days with my dad. And this was at the end of August, beginning of September. And as I said, he passed away a month later. And when we were there, that's what we talked about. And I, all these years later, you know, it's now been 21 years and since Dad passed away. And I think about what we talked about, you know, which was not the world championships or all of that, but that riding around with that ice chest and he laughed and still would laugh about, you know, next exit. I'm sure you probably heard that too. You
know,
Yeah.
It sounds exactly like what my dad and I did. My dad, I don't have my dad either. So that's the last things that we would do is we would talk about the travel, the races, all the little funny things that happened along the way, the roller dogs at 2 a.m. at a gas station.
Right.
Exactly. Just those things. And you hold on to them and you cherish them.
Yes, absolutely.
And you really, really got to me there with the book. So well, I really appreciate that part of it.
Well, good. And I, like I said, when I was doing that part, it's obviously emotional. It's a laugh. It's powerful. And it's in that relationship part that what my dad and I share. And I was so grateful that I got that feeling I should go home for those 3 or 4 days because I was in Vegas and, you know, and I was doing my school. So I wasn't seeing my parents maybe once or twice a year. And I hadn't even been home to see dad, or mom, in 99 yet. And so, that would have been tragic if I hadn't had those few days with him. But you know, you travel and it's little things. If you remember, I said in the book about, and I laugh about this all the time. I was talking with Loris Caparossi and Franco and Chini, and I were talking in the last race in Portugal. We were sitting around and I was going, you know, one of the funniest things for me driving along was because we didn't wear earplugs. And, you know, when I was a kid, didn't think about it, the sound, we didn't have, you know, mufflers or anything, silencers on the pipes, 2 strokes, and they were noisy. And I could hear the engine noise. I'd be riding along and in the middle of the night, we're driving, you know, from North Carolina, you know, back to Shreveport and trying to get back home so I can go back to school next day or something. And I could still hear the bikes, the engine noise in the wind.
Yeah, I can do you that know? Too.
Yeah, yeah, right. And you're not the only one. I've had quite a few come up and say, you know, I thought I was the only one. I go, no, there's a bunch of us, you know. And it's funny, and you know, and you and I just it's one of those things that it just makes me smile, you know. Mm,
yeah, I agree. Something else I think would maybe hopefully make you smile is the 3-cylinder Honda that you raced in GP to your first world title. Definitely a unique motorcycle. What do you remember of that bike? Was it really underpowered compared to the 4-cylinder Yamahas?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was underpowered. It was because initially it was there was some fault with the design of the engine. Especially before they had counterbalancing, it vibrated. The first time I rode it, it vibrates so bad, my hands would go numb, you know? But the whole purpose of that design, by a Japanese engineer who was basically created the Elsinore in the 70s and the 2-stroke Honda motocross bikes, Mr. Miyakoshi. The whole purpose was is for the engine would be narrow, so the overall width of the bike could be narrow and it could be light. At that time, the minimum weight in 500 Grand Prix was only 100 kilos, and no bike was near 100 kilos, you know. So they were probably around about 130, you know, maybe 115. My 85 bike was actually 114. The 4-cylinder. So, you know, but no one was near, you know, the minimum weight. So anyway, that was the goal of that bike, to be narrow, aerodynamically lighter, which should help in direction change. You know, a bike is a rolling gyro. So getting it to change direction from a straight line, right or left, the lighter the bike, you know, the better it should be, or it will, the better it does. Is, you know, once you get it over, it change direction, hold the line a little bit better. And you know, speed wise, if you have increased corner speed, it would increase exit speed. It would negate some maybe the power advantages that a 4-cylinder might have. So overall lap time should be a little better, a little bit lighter, should be easier on tires. And also the way that engine was designed, the characteristics of the bike initially, it was very responsive at low RPM. There was kind of a dip in the mid-range, and it didn't rev very high. Again, being a three-cylinder, and because it vibrated, had some vibration issues. It was limited on how many, you know, the maximum RPM was. Again, being a three-cylinder engine. So that was the purpose of the bike. Again, initially, there were some issues with the vibration, and you know, it had good power right off the bottom, but it didn't have the horsepower that we needed. But in a very short amount of time, that bike became pretty decent. It seemed to fit me. Part of it is I could adapt. Some of the other riders, Marco and Takazumi, I know, you know, struggle with it. The only rider to win a race besides me in those first 2 years, 82 and 83, was Takazumi. He won Sweden after I dropped out of the race in 82. So there was, like I said, there were some issues with the bike being adaptable to different riding styles. And most people did struggle on getting the best out of the bike.
So I have a question about the 84 bike that came after the three-cylinder. So it's the first four-cylinder Honda. And we all know it was upside down, gas tank underneath of the engine, exhaust pipes running over the top. And basically what we know now is that the gyro part of a motorcycle is along the center line of its two axles. It's not low center of gravity like a car. But my question is this, was that bike hot to ride because the exhausts were right there at your chest?
Yeah. Well, the first part of what you said is entirely correct. You know, the belief at the time was to try to make it more like a car, you know, very low. But a car doesn't lean and it doesn't transfer weight. But they tried to limit that by having the center gravity so low. And that bike, even though we struggled with that, and it was extremely difficult because of trying to stabilize the fuel issues. And I, you know, again, I talked about that in the book. It taught us a lot. The first time that I raced the bike at Daytona in 84 is when the pipe split. You know, I was leading the 200. Everything was going well. Got to the second fuel stop. Kenny and I, as we had done the previous two years, were battling. And this race was really important because I wanted to win the 200 on the last year of that original circuit because they were going to change it. And everything was going fine until the pipe split. And when it split, it obviously killed the power, but it also burned a hole in the top of that fuel tank, fake fuel tank. And wow, that's when it was hot. But other than that, not really.
Really?
Okay. The materials they had, it was pretty amazing. It would get warm to the touch, but there was really no other time where that was an issue. And they would also, they had some ducts, you know, that would run air through there. The big issue was at altitude is the bike would actually, the air in the carburetor area, because of the pipes being right over the top of those, of that part, they couldn't get enough cool air in there, and the air was hot, and it would really affect the performance. We at altitude, like someplace like Salzburgring, it would lose so much power as soon as it would start, you know, the temperature would get to a certain point, engine temperature, and it just would get hot. Or again, if it was the air was too thin in general, it would affect the performance.
We moved to 1985, which I think is probably the most amazing season that anyone's probably ever had, winning both the 250 and 500 titles. I didn't realize Honda didn't have a 250cc bike before you asked them to build one for you.
No, they didn't.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they had a production-based, engine-based bike that that Joey Dunlop was riding, like at the Isle of Man. I think he rode it a little bit. But just basically no budget. You know, they were just had a bike, and because eventually, you know, they were going to build one. They were going to build a proper works bike, but it wasn't going to be for 85. Because when we really decided to do it, which, as I talk about in the book, is an asset. And that was 3 months before the season was going to be ending, and, you know, basically 5 months before we need to start testing. And you just can't build a bike from the ground up in that short amount of time. Not a works bike, because there's nothing comparable or that would be used from that production-based kind of bike that they build a couple using, you know, this production-based engine. That was going to be for a street bike. So the works bike was completely different. But that was one of the greatest things that happened, because it allowed Mr. Hareke, who went on to the only thing he had built and designed, built, and was before that, was that wheel that exploded on me in 84, the carbon fiber. The first carbon fiber rear wheel was on any wheel, but it was the rear wheel was on my bike, the 84 bike. It came apart in South Africa in the beginning, in March of 84. Well, he was a young engineer and building wheels, we realized, and they realized, was not his forte. So he got the opportunity to start fresh, and that was brilliant, because he built this thing, designed it, and in those days, no computers, you know, it was all by hand, and or just starting to use computers, but they basically, you know, hand-drawn bike, and he designed, built, they manufactured this thing, hand-built it in a little over 3 months. And it allowed him to start from a clean sheet of paper, because the 84 bike was a disaster as far as that technology was not the direction to go. And that was what Miyakoshi wanted, is, you know, the success of the three-cylinder gave him the opportunity to be the project manager for the V4. And he believed in this, of the theory of the center of gravity as low as possible and controlling the transfer of weight forward and back more like a car. And that was not the direction as we know today. And so that's why the bikes are higher. You got real ride height, more trail, you know, which allows the bike at lean angle to steer and again, perform much, much better. So, but Hareke believed in that before anyone else. And so when he built that 250, it was amazing from the very first time I rode it. I can still remember those first six laps of Suzuka in the fall of 84. And I said, it's best bike I'd ever ridden up to that point. And I said, we should just build a bigger one of these for the 500. And it was building that 250 that really showed them the direction they needed to go, which was the conventional way, and also to get some rear ride height, the unit ProLink rear suspension, which Mr. Kanazawa had taken in design, which is what is still used today with the Link system. Those were all my engineers. And it's interesting, and as we were talking earlier about the little moments in life, I think we get those little moments where we have a choice, and that to me, looking at what we did in 85, certainly was an amazing feat in modern times. In the early years, 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, multiple classes were ran, but it's like on the 350 and the 500, like the MVs, it was the same motorcycle, just different displacement. Or, the 250 and 350, basically same motorcycle, just different displacement. But the 250 and the 500 were completely different in every way. And that's why that championship was difficult, and no one had ever been able to win the 250 and the 500. And I was able to do it with the support I had, the great team I had. I mean, you look at the crew I had. Jerry Burgess was one of my 500 mechanics, who obviously went on with Wayne Gardner and Valentino Rossi, and Irv Katamoto was my crew chief. Stuart Shenton was my 250 mechanic, and he went on with, with Cort Ballantyne, of course, and then with Kenny Jr. and Kevin. And so it's a teamwork and engineers. But I look at it more than that. I look as it was the choice to do those things is what gave people to step out of their comfort zone and take risk and design things and believe in what they could do, as Mr. Hiriki did, even though he had the failure of the rear wheel design, but he knew he could design chassis. Well, that gentleman not only went on to build that 250, he built my 500 chassis. He went on to be, redesigned the Interceptor, the VFR 800. He designed the chassis that won Nicky and the engine and the chassis combination that won Nicky his world championship in 06. So belief, right?
Right.
Sometimes it just takes that one opportunity, and then who knows? Look at all the great things. The F4I,
Yeah.
He's a lot of great things.
Yeah, I could go on forever with crazy motorcycle engineering nerd type questions, but time's running short. So I'd like to ask you, with your permission, of course, you're now working for Dorna as a race steward. Do you enjoy that?
Yes. It's a job that I never would have pursued. I got a phone call in the fall of 18 from Mike Trimby. Mike Trimby is the present CEO or CEO of IRTA. And people familiar with MotoGP and Grand Prix racing may not know what IRTA is, but a lot of your listeners may not. It's the International Race Team Association. And its job is basically, it is race direction. It handles all of the tech inspections. And it is the representative of all the race teams. And in connection of that, the riders. Mike Trimby, I know, because when we formed the Grand Prix Riders Association in 1984, after it had been tried a few times, we formed it with two goals. One, to make it safer, the Grand Prix racing safer, to get the prize money up, because basically we were supporting Formula One. And the other is for the privateers, to give right away them more support. You can have 10 factory bikes out there, let's say in those days in the 80s, but the fields were 36 riders. And so if you don't have, the support of the privateer, then you're not going to really have good racing. And so anyway, that was the purpose that we formed that. And myself, Randy Mamola was supportive of that, and Christian Saran and Raymond Roche and Eddie. And so the person that was hired to represent us was Mike Trimby. And Mike and I worked together to get that going. And then when in the late 80s, when Dorna came in and basically bought out Bernie Ecclestone and got the commercial rights from the FIM, they went in partners with Dorna and created what is now MotoGP. And so I got a call from Mike, and he said, listen, we're interested in the FIM MotoGP stewards panel, and we'd like you to be chairman. We want to improve some issues. One of them is what we see, the slow riding and things in Moto3, and basically from have a person from a rider's perspective. And we'd like to have you. And I thought about it, and I basically said, if I can contribute, because I care about motorcycling. One of the things I've been doing for years is doing classic events here in Europe. And after I stopped doing my school and basically been traveling around. And again, I care about the sport that has given me so much. And I like doing it. It's not easy, of course, you know, but it's also very rewarding. And we've made some improvements, and we'll continue making some improvements that are good for the sport and also the riders and all the classes so yeah, I look forward to doing it, and I look forward to this year. Hopefully 2021 will be a little bit easier. I want to tell you, getting 14 races stuffed into 5 months was really tough. Because we were doing three races and a week off and three races. That was hard on everyone.
It was harder on us too to do the show, because it was three weeks in a row watching races and whatnot, but definitely not as hard as you guys. I want to tell you that I think that you being chairman for Dorna for race direction is a fantastic move.
I'm representing IRTA. Basically, I'm the IRTA representative on the FIM MotoGP stewards panel. And I have the other permanent steward is actually Bill Cumbo, who is from the AMA. And Bill represents the FIM. And then we have a rotating third steward. And then we have appeal stewards. And, you know, it's grown just in the 2 years I've been there of the responsibilities from, you know, we've made improvements on the yellow flag situations or track limits. And like I said, there's quite a few people involved, but the stewards panel is basically made up of three people.
I think it's fantastic that you're a part of it. I think MotoGP is better because of it. So I wish you all the best in that position. I hope 2021 is fantastic and is as good a season as the 2020 season was. And with that, I think we'll end the interview there, Freddie. I appreciate your time so much.
Well, thank you very much. And I would like to say this to all the fans and all your fans, your podcast. I hope everyone keeps healthy and safe. And to all the fellow motorcyclists out there, have a great 2021.
Thanks, Freddie.
Thank you.